Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Steve Pappas, sitting in for Rick Sengeri. Today is Monday, August 8th, the day before the Vermont primary. The weeks leading up to tomorrow's voting has swamped us in mailings, radio, and television ads, and pages of print devoted to the candidates. We have an array of candidates running both for the legislature, statewide offices, and U.S. Congress. We've learned a lot about these individuals. Much is at stake in Vermont and the nation, and there is a different crop, and this is a different crop of issues that the winners are going to be facing beyond tomorrow and whoever comes out on top in the general election in November. Joining me today to talk about some of these issues are two individuals who understand Vermont politics quite expertly. In the second hour of the show, former Associated Press journalist Chris Graff will join Vermont Viewpoint to talk about shifts in politics and how the Vermont media covers these races. But in a moment, we're going to be joined by Jack Krasinski, chair of the Political Science Department at the University of Vermont. As always, we want listener participation. As tempting as it may be, we do not want campaigns nor members of the listening audience calling in with endorsements today. Today, we want to focus on trends and issues. Everyone with a vested interest will get a say at the polls tomorrow, which will remain open all day Tuesday until 7 p.m. Listeners, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255 or email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Jack, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on. Pleasure as always.
Yeah. So this is an interesting situation because we are about to see a massive kind of shift in Vermont politics, no matter how you look at it. But what we're seeing, and my paper, the Times Argus and Rutland Herald have been covering, has definitely shown a different kind of candidate up to this point. And they're talking about really fundamental issues of affordability and climate change and kind of the bellwether issues. But there's a different tone, both in candidate and issue. And I wanted you to just talk a little bit about what are you observing? Are you seeing a different crop of candidate running for office right now? And more importantly, why would you run for office right now?
I would agree with you in terms of things looking a little different these days. And I think, you know, you can really tie that to the critical state we are in a number of different areas, the state of our democracy, the state of climate being two of the major areas. And then, of course, the Supreme Court's decision in the Dobbs case, although that predated the current crop of individuals. But I do believe it's a nature of the times. And we also have a generation and on the gun issue as well. And we also have a very active, motivated new generation, the Zoomers or Gen Z, who they're the ones in schools who are the victims of the mass shootings in schools these days. Mm. And that has really motivated them, going back to the shooting in
Sorry, we're having a technical
issue. Yeah, technical difficulty. Sorry about the interruptions. Back to the Florida high school shooting at Marjorie Taylor High School.
Going.
Okay.
All right. Sorry about that, folks. We're having a technical issue, but we'll get it straightened out.
Anyway, the context right now is really something that I think a lot of people are concerned about. All of those issues are motivated to run. And, you know, there's a parallel I can see actually in my own job in terms of the enrollments in political science. We have had at the University of Vermont a tremendous increase in the number of students coming in wanting to study political science. And, you know, the reason is democracy's in danger right now. And there are all these, you know, some would say existential issues out there that really are motivating people.
There's a young man in Montpelier, 17 years old, who is...
Merrick Modine, right?
Yeah. He's actually too young to be running for... He can't vote,
yeah.
Right? He can't even
exactly.
Vote for his own race.
But he's a good indicator of that Generation Z being so motivated that they're willing to really jump in and they want to be represented. They want their voices represented in government.
So a few times I've been actually up at the University of Vermont talking to your classes and have been called out for being critical of the fact that I was saying that they consume information in a different way. They're consuming a lot of information, and it's a lot of information that's really relevant to them. So we are, as you said, we're seeing a level of engagement right now that kind of far exceeds what we've seen in a long time. And I guess is that having that generational gap changing the level of the discourse and debate among candidates? Like, are we seeing older candidates being more challenged?
I do believe so. You know, it actually started with the millennial generation before them. You saw a large uptick in their participation. A lot of people like to beat up on young people not participating, mm-hmm. but that has not been the case in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe, you know, not just all those existential crises, but the fact that there clearly is a difference between the two major parties on all of these issues make it so participating, you know, if you're going to run and you're concerned about climate or about abortion rights, you know, it's clear which side you take a stand on and fight for in terms of this environment. So I'm referring in some ways to the polarization. There's a lot been said about, you know, negatively about polarization and definitely the nastiness of campaigns and the personal nature of that, especially on social media, is problematic. But the fact that there's policy polarization, that there clearly is a choice between the two major parties right now, I think also drives greater participation. People can see the connection between their participation and what actually happens.
Yeah.
So, sorry, I was going to go back to the 2016 election, but if you didn't know the difference in 2016, you know it now.
Right.
That, you know, you didn't vote for Hillary Clinton, you know, you know right now you lost abortion rights in a lot of states around the country. And it, you know, wasn't as crystal clear then as it is now to people, I think.
Yeah. I misspoke earlier. He's no longer the chair of the department, but he was for 5 years.
Yeah, I finished that sentence.
No, see, that's not nice. It can't be. It couldn't have been that bad.
No, it wasn't.
So before we went on the break, you were talking a little bit about the growth that we are seeing at the moment in enrollment in the political science department and kind of the groundswell of that younger generation and how that is shaping the debate that we may be seeing playing out. So a lot of folks are going to be pretty cynical and say, young people don't know these issues. They can't actually speak to it, right? And you and I were talking a little bit about how they're consuming information in different ways. They're listening to podcasts. They're listening to, you know, they're really actually doing kind of deeper dives than some previous generations had done. And yet it comes down to folks have to make a decision about, do we want the security of candidates who know how to do this? Or do we want young blood and fresh eyes to come in? And Vermont's at a pivotal moment right now where, you know, there were a lot of the issues that you were talking about, but there's a lot that goes into economic recovery right now, bringing in workforce and workforce development, growing education, you know, growing families and bringing them to Vermont. Is it more attractive, do you think? Well, we'll start there. How do young people and the electorate reconcile with each other in being a candidate against kind of the system?
A lot of points there to address. I think first off, I want to say in terms of their consuming a lot of media and I would also add that they're a little more savvy, I think, than older generations about misinformation and about social media, because they've grown up into that. Whereas older generations, and I have this conversation with my students a lot, are, you know, used to an age where we had gatekeepers in the media who would filter that stuff. But this younger generation comes up at a time where, you know, there are no gatekeepers, and they're quite aware of that. Then in terms of experience and all of the issues and knowing the issues, I think if you talk to, and, you know, one of my areas of studies was state legislatures in grad school, and in years after that, my first book was on the subject. There's a steep learning curve for everybody who gets into the legislature. You know, points about, I've seen quotes, you know, I just learned where the bathrooms are, and now I have to run for reelection kind of deal, kind of. That state legislators face. So I don't think the younger generation is going to be handicapped in such a way that people might think they are. You could be around for a long time and run for the legislature, and you'll be just at the same point as well kind of the learning curve of how it all works. And given their motivation, you know, and the students actually – political science, UVM, we have a lot of students in the current contest right now. You know, Christina Nolan was one of our honor students who's running for the U.S. Senate on the Republican side. I have a ton of students working in all of the campaigns, but, now I'm forgetting who the other individual on the Democratic side was, but Molly Gray is a grad of UVM, not political science particularly. She did talk to my students at one point a few years back, but I think, you know, the learning curve is steep for everyone, you know, the U.S. House is going to be really different from the Vermont State Senate, for example.
Yeah.
Well,
let's talk a little bit about that, because we're seeing not just a shift in age, but we're seeing more women running for office and even transgender individuals running for office. That's a lot different than what we've seen in the past. And it's going to absolutely reshape potentially statewide offices and probably that Congress seat.
Most definitely. Be the first representative from Vermont to be not a male. I tend to think in a democracy, you want everyone to be able to be represented, their voices represented in government. So I can't help but think from a democratic standpoint, in terms of democratic supporting democracy, that that's a great thing that's happening in terms of representation. We've seen it in leadership in the state legislature, both the Speaker and the Senate President, and now with Becca Ballant running for the U.S. House race, and, you know, even in the candidates for other former student, Charity Clark, who's running for the Attorney General's office. So we have, women running for that office, just looking at the overall composition of the state legislature, Vermont's ahead of a lot of other states in terms of representation of women, where we're getting, you know, we have much more closer to parity as you might want to have in a democratic society.
Is that a concern that there will be so much turnover in this election cycle that we're actually potentially putting the state's future at risk?
Turnover in the legislature is an issue in some areas, in the sense that, you know, Vermont has a very citizen legislature, so there isn't really they don't come into having a staff other than they have the joint fiscal staff, and they have the legislative council's office that can help them out. But the individual legislators and the committees don't really have the kind of policy staff that can help them acclimate and provide them with the information they need. And so the new legislators are going to have to be aware of that. There's a great orientation that's provided for legislators early on that helps address that kind of issue. But if there's a high level of turnover, People, a lot of people are new to it. Then you have to think about what are the other influences that could have an impact on legislators who are kind of new to it and don't have the institutional memory. So interest groups, obviously. But we have a lot of powerful, we have powerful interest groups, and they tend to be on the left in this state, tend to be the most powerful. The governor will have a little more influence, although being from the opposite party, maybe not so much so. Legislative leaders then become really important as well in terms of managing the House. Senate, not so much since it's a smaller number and they do tend to have more experience.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, you can call us at 802-244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255 to join the conversation. You can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Fred from Newbury is on the phone. Fred, it's been a long time.
Morning.
How are you?
Hey, hey, Fred. I have got two questions, and I think they're both related. They say that there's 30 million people that are in the pool, and they're qualified for military service. And now the big problem is, of all the people that are willing to join the Army, they have a major problem with paragraph comprehension, and so they're disqualified. So now the follow-up question is, do you think the American people would vote for reinstating the draft, or would they vote for reinstating prohibition? It's a mouthful.
Okay, thanks, Fred, for the call. So, Jack, Fred from Newbury was asking about whether or not the electorate in America might be willing to reinstate the draft at this point.
Yes, and sorry, Fred, we have technical difficulties, so I can't really hear the questions coming in at this point. But I think we're pretty far away from something like reinstating the draft. Ask that question again, in another several months or whatever, depending on what happens with the war in Ukraine and the actions, activities of Putin, but I think right now that's really way down on the list of things.
We've got about a minute before we go to the break for the half hour, but Jack, when you're talking to your students, what are the issues that are driving them right now? You were talking about how this is a generation that grew up amid mass shootings in schools, and they're growing up with these drills, and so they're more aware of certain things that other generations weren't. What are they talking about? What's pressing them?
All of these things that I mentioned early on, and I have to say that a lot of them are, they're frightened about the future, and taking a look at these issues, rightfully so. And so that, that's, they're not giving up. They're not saying, getting depressed and dropping out. They're getting depressed and wanting to do something about this. So gun control, climate, I think climate is really quite big right now on the agenda. And the abortion rights, definitely the case. As well. And if you look at actually the partisan breakdown of the different generations, we have, the millennials and Gen Zers are much more pro Democratic Party, if you would, because of where they come down, where both the party comes down on the issue and where the generation comes down on the issue. So there's a division, a partisan division that you, if you go back in time and look at other generations, Gen X, the boomers and so on, you'd have to go back to the greatest generation to see a divide that is that big, and you wouldn't even see it then. That fits into that notion that, there's that policy polarization in terms of what the parties are going to do. The younger generation see that. They're funneling their activity into supporting the parties. And I think, you know, key to that is the recent success the Senate has had in the legislation that just passed that addresses climate change and some of these other issues.
Yeah. All good stuff. Thank you, Jack. And we're going to take a quick break and let the sponsors have their moment and join some news. And we will be back with Jack Rosinski on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Did you know that Radio Vermont Group Digital Services can create videos, including drone footage? We've even won awards for our videos. If you'd like to learn more and see examples of our work, go to rvgdigital.com. Radio Vermont Group. We're more than just radio.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Stephen Pappas, sitting in for Rick Sangeri. My guest is Jack Rosinski, professor from the University of Vermont Political Science Department. Jack, talk a little bit about how inflation, the economy, and what appears to be the threat of a recession has on – what do those factors have on an election and how people are thinking about candidates, honestly? You know, what are they thinking when they go to the polling place?
Certainly. I do want to make sure that I correct. I misspoke on the high school. It's Marjorie Douglas High School, not Taylor. The big issues, you know, inflation, the threat of a recession, obviously those, political scientists, we've studied elections for quite a long time. They usually play a big role in the state of the economy, the popularity of the president, and the outcome of the midterm elections in terms of how many seats the president's party wins or loses in the House, U.S. House and Senate. And I think it was shaping up to look like that those would be dominant. But I do believe the Supreme Court's ruling on the abortion case and now the Democrats' success with getting through the climate change bill, as well as the January 6th committee, I think all those things changed the context a little bit. And I do think the court's ruling on abortion is going to really motivate turnout on that issue, as we saw in the Kansas case, in a very red conservative state. Abortion rights won big time in that case. So I think those economic issues are going to kind of drop down the list a little bit in terms of how important they're going to be to the outcome of who controls the House and Senate.
Well, and the Senate just passed the anti-inflation bill over the weekend, and House is going to be taking it up, and hopefully Americans are going to see a little bit of relief out of that. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to say that fuel prices are going down, but it doesn't feel like they're going down
that
much.
The fact they're going down too, I mean, that might be subtly just show up. At least that's not at the top of the news. One of the things we know is that the issues that tend to be at the top of the news that are discussed the most tend to be the ones that kind of prime people to think about those when they walk into the voting booth. Mm. So, you know, if inflation drops down, gas prices aren't at the top, but abortion rights, January 6th committee, climate change, you know, wildfires, the flooding in Kentucky, all those rise to the top. That's going to influence what's at the top of people's minds. Mm-hmm. And researchers in political science have shown that what's at the top of people's minds tends to influence their vote much more. And I think the sort of context or the environment of our elections has shifted recently. So it may not be inflation and possible recession driving things as much as we thought.
Mm-hmm. So Chris Graff is going to be coming in for the second hour of the show. And he wrote a commentary that appeared in the Times Argus and Rutland Herald this weekend and had circulated around the state prior to that, where he's talking about how important this particular primary is for Vermont. And he and I can talk about his reasons why he thinks that important. I want to hear why you feel that this primary may be more important or maybe it's not. Maybe you don't think it's as important as other primaries, but it feels more important.
I think it is very important. I thought that was a great, great piece by Chris in the Times Argus. I would guess there's a couple things I'd want to hit on. As Chris pointed out, you know, in the state of Vermont, winning the Democratic primary is tantamount to winning the general election. And in essence, that's why we see so much competition in these primaries. We actually see it on both sides, some good competition in the Republican primary and the Democratic primary this time around. And one of the rules is the greater the probability of winning the general election, the more intense the competition in the primary election, especially when you don't have incumbents running. Mm-hmm. And with Senator Leahy retiring, that kind of eliminated the logjam of a lot of, candidates, individuals who wanted to run for a higher office or office in general, jumping into the race, plus, as we talked earlier, the younger generation being motivated. So we do see, you know, the policy differences are not huge on the Democratic side. There's, you know, a little bit of daylight, but not much between Molly Gray and Becca Ballant. The last debate had some, you know, discussion of criminal justice areas that there seems to be a little bit. But, you know, bottom line on, you know, the Democratic side, you are going to get support for a set of policies that, you know, fighting climate change and much more progressive policies, regardless of whether it's Molly Gray or Becca Ballant running. There's a little, you know, the Leahy faction of the Vermont Party versus the Sanders progressive side of the state. But I don't see that as being huge. On the Republican side, there might be actually more of an issue about, well, which way is the Republican Party going? Mm-hmm. And in the lieutenant governor's race with Senator Benning, former Senator Joe Benning, running versus Greg Thayer.
Yeah.
That, you know, is the Republican Party going to continue? Are they going to go the route of the Phil Scott, more moderate approach? You also see that in the U.S. Senate race with Christina Nolan being more of that in the Benning and the Scott side of things versus, what is it, Gerald Malloy?
Malloy, yeah.
Yeah, Malloy. So that, you know, in there's, you know, what direction is the party going to go? Is it going to go towards the Trumpian side of things, more on the extreme, or is it going to stay more on the moderate side of things for the Republican Party? And for them to compete in this state, going more Trumpian is kind of going to make it harder for them to win general elections. But, you know, a broader point about primaries in our system that I think is really important. You know, a lot of people complain about the two-party system, but one of the things that we, the U.S., has that other nations that have multi-party systems don't have is the primary system. Mm-hmm. And the primary system allows voters to get in there and decide which direction they want their party to go. So they have some control over it in terms of what they stand for in the general election. And so we see that maybe more so in the Republican Party than the Democratic Party this time, although there are, you know, some differences in the Democratic Party in terms of how progressive the party will go.
The Times Argus and Rutland Herald both hosted or moderated forums that were introductions to the community of the various candidates and let them talk about the issues. They were less debates and more kind of, you know, here we are and here are the questions were geared toward level of experience, anecdotes about, you know, where they're coming from on certain issues and then specifics on what their policies would be. And as you say, the differences were nuanced. But what has been interesting to my staff has been that this is a really good crop of candidates, kind of across the board. And they're talking about things that really matter to Vermonters. They're not just talking out of the playbook. They're not just talking to get reelected or to get elected. They're actually talking about things because it's affecting them directly too, which has been great to see. Yeah. It's led to a really good discourse, I think.
I'd agree with that. And that goes back to our earlier part of our conversation. What is motivating all these people to run? People are really cynical about politicians and politics. But if you look at what we are facing in terms of the state of our democracy, climate, gun control, abortion rights, all those sort of things, that they're motivated by trying to have an impact on the system, most of them. It's funny because I have to talk to my students about that. They come in really cynical about politicians, and it's like, do you really know any politicians? How do you know what their motives are? You know, the only thing you way you know it is through media and media coverage, which often focuses on game coverage. That is, it just focuses on what they're doing to try to win as opposed to what their real motivations are and what their background is. So, yeah, and now I think, given the state of things, both in the state and nationally and internationally, that those motivations are even more powerful for pushing people into the electoral arena.
I think you just called journalists a bunch of cynical. But we're gonna let that one go.
Actually, there's a lot of journalists. They have conversations about this, about how they cover things. So.
They do. And you're right. We do have to go for the things that are, you know, reporters are going to cover the things that are, they think are going to be the most interesting to the most people. Yeah. And it may not be the chronology, but that's why you have things like PEG Access that are so important, so that you can go back and you can watch an entire discussion and get the, you know, essentially the verbal transcript of it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we're better off now in this day where, you know, it used to be media coverage was so ephemeral. You couldn't go back and, you know, if there was coverage of the issues, you couldn't go back and take a look at it. But now with the internet, you can.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, and it also raises the accountability factor a lot.
Yes.
So I teed it up that you and I have been at, not loggerheads exactly, because we've actually never talked about it in person, about ranked choice voting. But your feeling is, well, I guess first of all, we should probably explain what it is. I'll let you okay. Tee it up. And then I want you to explain why you think that it's such a bad idea. And then I'll come back at you, because hopefully it'll be about the end of your hour and I'll get the upper hand.
Right. Right. So I did write a piece that appeared in the Times Argus, and it might be, you know, you can refer back to that if you want to look at it, because it's easier to get things through reading than talking necessarily. But there are a number of different reasons why I don't think it's a very good idea. And I actually think there's an alternative to that called cumulative voting that is actually a better alternative voting system than ranked choice voting. And the key thing with ranked choice voting is, you know, there's a mathematician named Kenneth Arrow who won a Nobel Prize for his proof that showed when you do ranked choices, there are paradoxes that pop up. In particular, you know, you can have a situation where a majority of voters prefer candidate A to B, and a majority of voters prefer B to C, and then a majority of voters prefer C to A, and then you don't have – there's no majority. So you can't find the majority. Mathematicians then added on. They found a number of other paradoxes, like the no-show paradox, where some voters might actually be better off staying at home and not voting. And you don't want that in a democracy. And that actually happened in the 2009 mayoral election in Burlington. If Republicans had stayed home and not voted and moved their candidate up to the second spot, they would have gotten a candidate much more closer to their ideology, the Democrat, as opposed to the progressive. The other thing is, in that race, you could match to the individual head-to-head matchups, and the person who's preferred over everybody else in those head-to-head matchups can lose. And that actually happened in that race. The Democrat, Andy Montreux, lost, well, it was preferred by a majority over Bob Kiss, the progressive, and over the Republican. He ended up losing the race because of ranked choice voting. So there's those paradoxes that actually make your vote decision a lot more complex than the supporters actually sell it, that you vote for your preferences. But how you rank your candidates can actually affect the outcome. So you have to be just as strategic as you are in a normal race where there might be another runoff later on. The other thing is, if you look at U.S. ballots and compare them to ballots in other countries, we have much longer, much more complicated ballots. And so now, and, you know, this is not saying voters are dumb or anything along those lines, but you're now increasing the time and the decision costs of voting dramatically. And that's fine for political junkies. They love that stuff. But for everybody else who has their the lives they're living and all that other demands on their time, adding that complexity to the ballot is actually going to disenfranchise a lot more people and put it more in the hands of the political junkies. Another point is it really doesn't address any problem that we have in our political system right now. We have problems with campaign finance. We have problems with lopsided districts in terms of gerrymandering. We have a polarization. We have a discourse through the media that is nasty, vitriolic, that doesn't necessarily focus on the real policy differences between the parties. It doesn't really address any of those things. And in fact, you might actually get more extreme candidates in the case of ranked choice voting, as was the case in Burlington. You got the more far left candidate who ended up leaving office and not under really good terms. And Burlington voters were not happy with his tenure. And they also got rid of ranked choice voting after that election, after having tried it out that one time. Host of reasons why cumulative voting is something different. Cumulative voting is a system where you have, say, a three-member district, you have multi-member districts, you're given as a voter three votes, and you can cast all your votes for one candidate, or you can split those votes up among candidates. Illinois had that system until, I think, early 90s, and in research I was doing, I was interviewing legislative leaders around the country for my first book, and one of the legislative leaders in Illinois told me, once we got rid of cumulative voting, and what cumulative voting does is it means that minority candidates, either minor party or minority in terms of African Americans or some other underrepresented community, tend to get representation from many more districts because, you know, if you're a Republican in an overwhelming Democratic district, you go in, you cast three votes for all your votes for the Republican candidate. That guarantees you get at least one representative. And that moderates polarization. And that's what the legislative leader told me, that once they got rid of that system, polarization in Illinois just hit the ceiling. And so Lonnie Guinier, who was put forward by Bill Clinton for Attorney General, she was wrote about this in her sort of academic years. And I think and it doesn't have the paradoxes that ranked choice voting has. Mm-hmm. So there's part of the argument, if you would.
Well, we actually
used up all the time.
No, not yet. but we do have Rama on the phone. Rama from Williamstown. How are you, Rama?
I'm doing good. I'm going to make a statement. I'm not. There's no time to sit around and debate the issues. But your guess is entirely wrong about the IRV, especially as it applied to those earlier Burlington mayoral elections. Number one, they're reinstituting it in Burlington. Number two,
city
go back
races.
To those races that your guest is referring to. Nobody reached the required 40% minimum that was required under the pre-IRV and post-IRV rules for Burlington. Nobody reached that 40% level until Clavel did, when he got it on the third round of the voting. So, no, the voter's choice was very well respected. The numbers are out there. They're public. And either ignorant or misleading. So thank you.
No, that is completely unfair. The numbers are clear and they're out there. And if you look at the actual data from the ballot, you see the preference for the Democratic candidate over the other candidates by a majority of voters. So that is not ignorant. That is not misleading. That is actually factual.
Ron, we're going to have to put you on hold because we're coming up on the end of the hour, and I want to take a moment to thank Jack Krasinski for coming in and talking politics with us on the day before the primary. A lot of material covered, and little contention there at the end, and we apologize for the beginning of the show with the technical difficulties, which we have blessedly worked out. So thank you all for listening. And, Jax, thanks for being here. We are going to take a break, and after the break, I will be joined by Chris Graff, former Associated Press reporter and longtime political watcher of Vermont politics. And stay tuned for Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
We hope you're enjoying this podcast of Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary. You can find podcasts of some of the other programs on our website. In addition, we also have CBS podcasts, including Sunday Morning with Jane Pauley and 60 Minutes. For a full listing of podcasts, visit our website at WDEVradio.com.
And welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Chris Graff spent decades covering stories around Vermont. He has seen many shifts in power, be it in Congress, the State House, or various local statewide administrations. He recently published a commentary discussing the importance of tomorrow's primary vote. Listeners, we want you to join our conversation by calling us at 802-244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. You can also email questions to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Chris, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks. Great to be here. Yeah. Always great to be at DEV.
I think in a previous incarnation of this show, you and I were asked to both a guest host, and I was on one day and you were on the next day, and you had a great show. You would talk to your kids, I believe.
Oh, that's right. That was the last time I was here.
It was
that's
a great
right.
show.
I had my son in the first hour and my daughter in the second hour.
Yeah. Well, today we're going to talk some politics. I want to know why you feel tomorrow's primary is so important for the state of Vermont.
Well, Steve, I could be wrong, and whenever, as soon as I say this, a listener will say, well, no, don't you remember 1976 or something? But I don't remember a primary in Vermont where there have been as many strongly contested races at the statewide level, as well as the local and county level as well. You know, we have four very heavily closely contested races on the Democratic side tomorrow. Normally what happens in a primary, you may get one or two offices, but I don't remember four offices being this heavily contested. So I think that's one reason. Two, you know, the last time we had a U.S. Senate seat open and a U.S. House seat open at the same time was 2006. And that's a long time ago. What happens in Vermont is you win a state U.S. House or U.S. Senate seat, and you stay in it for decades. So this is huge to have both the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House open. You know, at the same time, we've got some pretty important and hotly contested county races. You know, you look at the Chittenden County State's Attorney's race is just one example.
Right.
So I think on the Democratic side, we're going to see a record turnout tomorrow in the primary. And that's really quite a statement, because 2 years ago during the pandemic, what happened was the state of Vermont sent everyone a request to get a mail-in ballot.
Mm-hmm.
So it came right to you. And we had this tremendous use of absentee ballots in 2020. 123,000 people voted by absentee ballot. So it was really boosted the turnout. Normally in an election primary, you might get 17,000 voting absentee. So the turnout in 2020 was 109,000 in the Democratic primary, 58,000 in the Republican primary, total of 168. That's a very high bar, much higher than we normally see in a primary. Mm. But I think on the Democratic side tomorrow, we'll beat that number of 109.
So this is an interesting crop of candidates. Jack and I were actually talking about how the field, these folks they're in a lot of these races are very qualified, and we're having a level of discourse that we haven't had in a long time, and that while within the party it's nuanced, they're talking about issues that actually really do matter to Vermonters, and that has led to what seems like a higher level of engagement from the public in attending forums, logging into forums, whatever it happens to be. I got to admit, this the hybrid version of campaigning where you can actually join a Zoom call right. and never leave your home is, you know, it has made campaigning quite different and quite interesting. But you look like you were going to make a point.
Well, I just was going to agree with you on that. You know, I've been able to sit at home and watch candidate debates all around the state.
Yeah.
And so you get a sense of, one, how the candidates are doing, not just when they're on the statewide television debate. And two, you get to hear what some of the audience questions are around the state, too.
Yeah. Are there particular issues that you think are shaping this primary above all others?
Well, on the Democratic side, I have to say that, you know, right off the bat, the election of women is probably a driving force. If you look at the U.S. House race, you know, the two top contenders are women. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like from the get-go, this election was about electing a woman to the U.S. House because of the fact that Vermont is the only state in the nation that has never had a woman be a part of its congressional delegation, either in the U.S. House or the U.S. Senate. But if you look at the race for lieutenant governor with Kitty Toll, or Secretary of State with Sarah Copeland Hansis, or Attorney General Charity Clark, you have strong women running in all of those races. Not all of them probably will win, but it seems to be an overriding issue this time. This election is about women. And this is really this organization that exists called Emerge Vermont.
Sure.
I think the other day they said that they have something like 43 of their graduates are on ballots up and down the ballots in Vermont. That's a sea change.
Yeah. Well, and the Supreme Court decision also has electrified a lot of the base, especially among, well, I guess both parties, but more, it seems more pronounced among the Democrats right now. How much do you feel the Supreme Court decision is going to affect not just the primary, but the coming weeks after the primary leading up to the vote in November on Proposition 5?
Well, I think we're going to see some strong campaigning on both sides on Proposition 5. I think one of the things, though, about the primary versus the general, you mentioned the commentary that I had in your paper yesterday, that the main point of that was that really this August vote, this vote tomorrow, is much more important than the vote in November for the statewide offices, at least, and for many of the regional and countywide and local elections, because Vermont is so heavily Democratic that winning the Democratic nomination these days is akin to winning the general election. And I think that, and again, you know, I've been really wrong with a lot of my guesses over the years and predictions going back 50 years. But the odds are that everyone who wins the primaries tomorrow will win in the November general election. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily in every case a Democrat, because we're, you know, counting Phil Scott as winning, but he will win his nomination tomorrow. So you've got Peter Welsh, the winner, then the winner of the U.S. House. You know, I think the Democratic candidate for lieutenant governor will likely win in November. But there's an asterisk there, because depending on who wins that, Joe Benning, who's a Republican and could win the nomination on the Republican side against Greg Thayer, he could be a strong contender in November, depending on who wins the Democratic nomination. But treasurer, we know that Mike Pichek, the former commissioner of the Department of Financial Regulation, will be the next treasurer. The Secretary of State nomination, whoever wins that, Sarah Copeland Hansis or Chris Winters, or the sort of also-ran of John Odom, the Montpelier City Clerk. And in the Attorney General race, Charity Clark or Rory Thibault, one of them will be the general election voter. Mm-hmm. So the race tomorrow, the election tomorrow, is absolutely critical. If you want to vote, you want to have a say in who your next elected officials are, voting tomorrow is really important.
Mm-hmm. So you just rattled off a whole bunch of people who are new to – going to be new faces. And we are looking at more than 30% of the House and Senate are going to be turning over. That's a lot of new faces. And Jack and I were talking a little bit in the first hour about what impact that basically is going to have. And he was saying that the learning curve is steep for everybody. But this feels like a pivotal moment for Vermont. There's a lot going on, whether it's COVID recovery, accountability for ARPA money, the Proposition 5, once again, there's going to be talk about Act 250. There's going to be talk about, you know, potentially tax reform, progressive tax reform, and a lot of things, a lot of the perennial things, but they're a little more charged this time. And with that many new people coming in, what do you think we're going to end up seeing there? Because it feels like new blood, new eyes, fresh eyes could be beneficial, but it also could have an impact.
I think it will have an impact. The Speaker of the House will likely stay the same. The governor will stay the same. There'll be a new president pro tem. There'll be a new lieutenant governor. And as you were saying, one-third turnover. We see a lot of turnover in the legislature being, as you and Jack were talking about in the last hour, a citizen legislature. But this is bigger, and the people who are retiring are more critical. The first year of a biennium is always pretty slow as people get to learn their way around the building and they need to get their committee assignments, all of that. I also think that, and you were just mentioning this, but really there's some big issues coming on for the legislature, and the biggest one really is going to be fiscal, because a lot of this federal money is coming to an end. Vermont is spending more, and this year's budget was bigger than any by tenfold, not really, but almost, because of the billions from the federal government. That's going to not be there, and so there's some tough decisions coming ahead.
Mm-hmm. So, backing up to a few months ago, why do you think so many people didn't decide to run again?
Well, in the legislature, I think there are two things going on. One, several of these folks decided to run for higher office. Becca Blatt, Molly Gray is lieutenant governor, Kitty Toll, Charlie Kimball. You look down the list, Sarah Copeland Hanses, a lot of these statewide officers are coming from the legislature, contenders. But two, I don't think we can understate or overstate, actually, the impact of the pandemic on the legislature. The lawmakers were exhausted by the end of this. Going since 2020 virtually, trying to balance what had to be done, it was a really rough 2 years for these legislators, and I think a lot of them just said, "I'm exhausted. I got to step away."
Yeah, and you gave a nice rundown of kind of the big name folks, the lawmakers, the legislators, who I guess have stepped back. It did surprise me that so many of them. Janet Ansel, for example, who were really in powerful and critical positions, and they were under a different kind of scrutiny with the pandemic too, which was interesting because you could again sit at home in your sweatpants and watch the committee hearings where you didn't otherwise, but. It created some challenges that, again, I agree with you that folks are just exhausted. Actually, we have a caller, Brian from Eden. Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How are you?
So good to hear you on the radio. My favorite news reporter. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, always have been. Another factor that came into play, I don't know if you're aware, but Lucy Rogers, who was from Waterville here as a representative, she wrote a bunch of op-ed pieces, and she decided not to run again just because she's a young person trying to get by, and she just couldn't afford to work for free. the commitment of time. You know, I mean, it is a huge burden to people who aren't really rich.
Yeah, you know, you're making a great point. And I think that Jack and Steve talked a little about this in the last hour. But, you know, one of our greatest assets is that we have a citizen legislature. But one of the greatest liabilities is we have a citizen legislature. You know, I think we as a state are we don't confront the fact that that how hard it is for our legislators to serve and that. They don't have the staff, which Jack was talking about last year. You know, they have the legislative council, but they don't have, you know, I used to give folks tours of the state house who would come up, either journalists or others, and they'd always say, well, where are their offices? And I said, well, they don't have any. Well, where's the staff? Well, they don't have any. And the model of the citizen legislature worked fine in the agrarian society, and that's why we have a winter session. But it doesn't work so well now.
We're going to take a quick thank you, Brian, for calling and raising that issue. I actually watched Lucy in a House committee meeting last year and was very impressed by her. And yes, as Jack was talking about in the first hour, young people running for office and having that say and bringing that fresh energy is really important to issues facing Vermont. And it is sad that is the case, especially with Lucy. Before we hit airtime, you mentioned that you were covering, not for AP, but you were covering your first race 50 years ago.
That's right. I was actually a student at Middlebury College, and I was worked on the college radio station, WRMC. I worked with Jim Douglas, who was there too at the college radio station. And I interviewed Tom Salmon. 1972, he was running for governor. It was the fall of 72. Dean Davis was the governor at the time, and he was very popular, chose not to run again, and he had handpicked his successor, Fred Hackett, a businessman and insurance executive. And Tom Salmon came back from the McGovern Convention, the Democratic National Convention for George McGovern in 1972. It was August, and he was all fired up, so he decided to run for governor. Think of that. He just announced in August of 1972 that he was going to run for governor as the Democrat in November. When you think about how long our campaigns are right now, pretty amazing. Well, I interviewed him on WRMC, the college radio station, and a lot of my questions were, gosh, how do you get up every morning knowing you're going to lose this election? That type of thing. And of course, he went on to win, years later, I was hopeful he forgot that, but years later when he was president at UVM, he introduced me to a group I was speaking to there and told that story. And I went, oh, he remembers. But, yeah. And I followed that up in 1974. I was working for the Valley Voice, an Addison County weekly, writing a political column. And I predicted that Dick Mallory would win the U.S. Senate race against Pat Leahy. And, of course, Pat won. So I stopped making public predictions then.
I was going to say maybe we should bring somebody else on for right now. But so let's talk a little bit about the races that you've teed them up, and Rick Sangeri's done an amazing job of actually interviewing a lot of these candidates on Vermont Viewpoint. What races are you watching carefully, and you know which one, if putting on your journalist hat, which one are you wishing you got the assignment for tomorrow night?
Well, the U.S. House race, of course, on the Democratic side, it's just a huge race, and it's just been fascinating to watch because, Molly Gray started out as the person to beat. She was the front runner. She had run a statewide campaign. She had strong name recognition. And if you haven't run a statewide campaign, generally it's hard for first-time candidates to run a statewide campaign. So here she is. She's running against Becca Valent, and Becca has not run a statewide campaign. She doesn't have much name recognition because of the fact most people don't know legislative leaders. She was from Windham County. Right. Most people in Vermont don't know Windham County legislators. And there was another progressive in the race at the time, Keisha Ram Hinsdale.
Right.
So you sort of thought, well, golly, Molly Gray's got the inside track on this. Plus, she had the endorsements at the time of Governor, or still does, but Governor Kunin, Governor Dean, later Pat Leahy, and she had, you know, experience with Peter Welsh's staff and has endorsements from folks who worked with Peter Welsh, so showing that, you know, that she had all of that. And then we've seen a tremendous change of the dynamics of that race. And as we go till tomorrow, you know, it looks like now Molly Gray's the underdog, and that Becca Valiant is the front runner. And that's just a sea change. So that's been a fascinating race. But I think each of these Democratic races that's contested, they have their own contingencies. They're strong candidates. So they're each competitive in their own way. So they're fascinating. And we have to just mention in passing, I think the turnout tomorrow will be very light on the Republican side. But that can cause some problems, too. And there's sort of a fight going on for the soul of the Republican Party on some of those races, and we may see some surprises in some of the outcomes in the Republican primary.
There was talk at one point, and Jack and I didn't get a chance to talk about it, but there is that anomaly with the primary where somebody can come in and a Republican can come in, grab a Democratic ballot.
Yeah, absolutely.
And vote for somebody who doesn't have a snowball's chance, so that potentially they become the nominee against the Republican candidate or splitting the vote.
Yeah. And what you've just pointed out is probably the most important thing about tomorrow. Vermont has an open primary. When you go to the polling place, you are handed three ballots. Progressive Party, Democratic Party, Republican Party. It's up to you in the privacy of the voting booth to decide which ballot you will mark up, and then you discard the two others. Little different in machine towns, cities, but that's pretty much how it works. It's called an open primary. There's no party registration in Vermont. There may be some people who do what you just suggested, you know, mischief-making in the other primary. But what tends to happen is Vermonters go where the action is. You know, there's always a small core that will stay with the Republican Party. There's a small core that will stay, or larger core, in the Democratic primary. But the large middle of independents will go to the primary where there's a lot of interest. And tomorrow, that's going to be the Democratic primary.
Right. Well, we are going to take a quick break and continue our conversation with Chris Graff here on Vermont Viewpoint. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about coverage of these campaigns and how it has shifted over time. So feel free to join us here on Vermont Viewpoint.
In decades past, you opened a business, hung out your shingle, and the customers came. Today, hanging out your shingle means creating an engaging website. The modern consumer is using the internet to find businesses like yours. Are you positioned so you'll rise to the top of their search? Let the Radio Vermont Group Digital Services work with you to make sure you're visible online and to target your marketing to location, demographic, and interest. Learn more at rvgdigital.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Steve Pappas, sitting in for Rick Sangeri today. Listeners, you should feel like you should join this conversation, too, and give us a call at 802-244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. You can also email comments or questions to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. My guest this hour is Chris Graff, former journalist for the Associated Press for 28 years. Chris, you've seen a lot and you've covered a lot, and you, as a political watcher right now, see how things are being covered today. And I will put it out there as a full disclosure that Times Argus and the Rutland Herald several years ago now, under my decision, cut back the Vermont Press Bureau as part of a cost-saving measure. in the hopes that the staff itself at the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus would absorb some of the issue-driven coverage of various things going on in the legislature and in the campaigns. And while that's been somewhat effective, it has not been entirely effective. And we're constantly trying to pivot and grow the coverage out more and improve upon it. We also did away with political endorsements because there were so few of us left at a management level that it would be an editorial board of one, which doesn't seem fair. I can't be the one to write the editorials and vet the candidates and do that kind of in a vacuum. So we took that step back a few years ago and also made an effort to make sure that endorsements that were coming in were not part of letter writing campaigns and that they were, again, very issue driven. So we started a policy where we started charging for endorsements and putting them, people would pay per word. That has felt like censorship to a lot of folks, especially folks who have grassroots campaigns where they get their neighbors and friends to write letters to the editor, in support. But there has been a movement in that direction in recent years, and other Vermont newspapers actually, adopted the same policy after we did. It has not been popular and, certainly has changed the tone of what has been in the papers. But with limited staff, and smaller newsrooms now, we focus more of our, coverage on, doing profiles of the candidates, covering the local forums and, debates, some of which we host and moderate. We're trying to grow our coverage by actually being part of the question and answer process. And that's the piece that we can do. And other folks, I mean, Rick Sengeri has done interviews with candidates. We hear it on VPR. We read it in other publications, mostly at a very hyper-local level. We are a long way away from what you saw when you were working for the AP, where, as you say, you were telling me on the break, there was a reporter assigned to every candidate 24/7. And newsrooms were robust, and we weren't worrying about how many pages the paper was going to be and what the cost was going to be. So talk a little bit about the shift that you have seen. Well, talk a little bit about what it used to be, because I think folks would be fascinated. Talk a bit about the shift, and then let's talk about are we seeing is the lack of coverage harming our ability to have an educated electorate?
So the short answer is yes, of course.
Yeah.
But here's the interesting thing about campaigns. In this world of focus groups and knowing everything, about products and things, we don't know why people vote as they do. We do not know, there have been lots of studies on this. What influences a person's decision to vote for candidate X? So that's why you will see out there today and yesterday and maybe tomorrow morning all these honking waves. Mm-hmm. This is why you are getting hundreds and thousands of mailers in the mailbox from these campaigns every day. You're seeing lawn signs everywhere, social media. You're hearing about endorsements. And as you just mentioned, the editorials of newspapers. We don't know what makes a difference in that. So that's why you see candidates doing all that they're doing, because they don't know. Is this tweet going to make a difference? Is that lawn sign on this lawn going to make a difference? We don't know what the difference is. We don't know why people – we do know – so endorsements. There's some people who will – a big endorsement like Bernie Sanders for Becca Bailyn, that's got to have an impact. But there's some people who will say, oh, well, if Bernie's for her, then I'm against her, mm-hmm. That type of thing. But we don't know what influences people's votes. That said, the news media has always had a very special role in trying to help educate. And there have been debates going on for decades as to how to balance what's called the horse race against the policy stories. You know, what's a person's background, or how do they feel about climate, or what is their record? And you'll see that a lot of the national media is criticized for still really focusing on the horse race. You know, is Trump up? Is Trump down? How's Biden doing? And that type of thing. But what we have seen in Vermont over the last 20 years, slowly, but definitely over the last 10 years, is we've seen local newspapers cutting back, or the wire service is cutting back, or the TV, or WDEV, you know, news staff, even, and we've seen a change in the news organizations, and we've seen a change in the approach. So what you mentioned, and I mentioned to you during the break, you know, in the late 70s and early 80s, your paper and the Rutland Herald, they're both your papers really, they put reporters on every campaign, and they did it for, I don't know, the month before an election, and they covered them day in and day out. And, you know, it was exhausting for those reporters, and they would cover, so Dick Snelling's running for governor as the Republican and Stella Hackel is the Democrat. You would see in the Rutland Herald and the Times Argus every day a Snelling story and a Hackel story from those candidates. Where did they go? What did they do? Who did they see? And definitely that was too much coverage. But where we are today is too little. And what we have seen, you know, some of these debates that have happened, I think they've been really important, these live debates, and we don't see daily coverage of it. We don't see – so WCX had a U.S. House debate last Thursday. It was a really strong debate. We didn't really see coverage that night or the next day, and then at the end of that day, we saw V.T. Dicker do a longer story, a takeout on it. And we tend to see that more, that there's sort of a pacing of these longer stories. And I'm not sure, you know, how much they get read. I think it's hard for the campaigns right now because it's hard for them to counteract something they may have seen. They don't have a news media outlet to go to, so they sort of resort to social media. But I think that a lot of us who follow these campaigns on social media are getting a warped sense of these campaigns. You know, most people in Vermont are not following the U.S. House race on social media, and they don't even know who the campaign managers are or the personalities or whatever. But the campaigns are putting a ton of effort into social media because they think that's how they are connecting with people and making and influencing voters. And that's a sea change from how it used to be.
Mm-hmm. You were talking a little bit before about the level of the coverage decades ago, and you hinted that it might be too much. It's interesting to know what the balance is, what the average reader does want now, because who's reading the papers and how they read and how they consume information has changed so much. Jack was talking in the first hour kind of about how the younger generation often will zero in on an issue and see how the various candidates work around an issue and have a say rather than the candidate themselves. I mean, there is a groundswell of young people running in campaign or working on campaigns. That's always been true. But it is interesting that longer form journalism often gets cast aside, that people actually don't read it. Even right. though, and there have been times where we have covered things in the paper and we have realized that the campaign hasn't even finished reading the whole story. And another interesting point that has come up lately is that at least in my case, where as soon as a candidate realizes that we don't do endorsements, I don't hear from them again. Mm-hmm. I get the press releases, but I no longer get the requests for interviews. I no longer get requests to hook them up with a reporter and have them spend time with them. When the endorsement isn't on the table, I'm less important. The Times Argus and the Rutland Herald have been less important, which has been an interesting shift as well. So we do have a quick, we're going to bring in a caller. Thanks for calling, Harry. What can we do for you?
Yeah, I don't know how Vermont can consider it an open primary when you only get to mark one ballot. In the general election, you can cross party lines, but you're never given that choice in a primary.
Yeah, well, that's part of the challenge of it. Yeah. That's for
and
sure,
that's
Harry.
True. And I've had people in the past say to me, geez, you know, I want to go and vote for X on the Democratic side and Y on the Republican side. And you have to say, no, you don't. You can't do that. And what why that is because what really tomorrow is all about is about the political parties picking their best candidates to go in the general election. Now, because Vermont's so heavily Democratic, you know, it's it sort of a lot of the big decisions are actually going to be made tomorrow. But one thing that's really important, Steve, that we just can't lose sight of when we're talking about the coverage and talking about the impact and everything, you know, we've spent a lot of time talking and writing and about these candidates. Tomorrow in the Democratic primary, if the turnout is a big turnout, and let's say that's 100,000, that's still only one-fifth of the registered voters in Vermont in the Democratic primary. So we're really talking about a small number and of people will be deciding these elections tomorrow compared to what we would see in the general election. In the last general election, which was a presidential election, we saw, you know, 360,000 people vote tomorrow in the Democratic primary. If it's a big primary turnout, we'll see over 100,000. Much different approach if you're a candidate and trying to reach those folks and identify your votes.
Yeah. Chris, on the break, we were talking about how some journalists segue into being lobbyists, some segue into being pundits. Still having a hand in how people think about and hear about candidates like this. Do you think that when that happens, even at a local, I mean, we certainly see it at a national level and international level where the pundits all of a sudden become these celebrities and these entertainers and all of that, that their influence, can often sway the discussion. We have a certain level of that in Vermont, but do you feel like the Vermont media as a whole is sticking to kind of that role of being objective, or are we seeing a shift in how stories are being put together and how they're written and even the overall coverage? Is it moving in a direction that you feel has empowered one side or another?
Well, I think the biggest story is the one that you've mentioned a couple times in this hour, which is the loss of people in the news business in Vermont. You know, what we have seen happening with local newspapers, you know, you were sort of talking about what you've had to do at the Times Argus and the Rutland Herald. Well, the thing is, you had to do it. You know, what we have seen happening to local newspapers and national newspapers and news organizations, except for very few, is the loss of the revenue has made it very hard to sustain the model that we have known forever. And so, you know, you and I were talking about the endorsements on the break, too. There was a time when the Burlington Free Press, and it wasn't that long ago, their editorial endorsement was huge. It could move, and the same thing for the Rutland Herald. And we'd often seen the Rutland Herald and the Burlington Free Press take opposite stands in their editorial endorsements at candidates. But candidates would work very hard, and they would prep for those editorial endorsement meetings at the Free Press, and it was an editorial board, and you know, it was very powerful. And as soon as those editorial endorsements came out, the campaigns would take out ads around the state in other newspapers promoting the fact they'd gotten the editorial endorsement of the Burlington Free Press or the Rutland Herald. Mm. So we have seen a sea change where now, you know, many of the newspapers are silent in endorsements, but also silent in their coverage. And all we can hope for is that, you know, papers like yours continue to focus on the local races that are happening. So there's, you know, a lot of local legislative races going on in Washington County, and the state's attorney race and things like that. That's where we can see local papers continue to make a difference. But we are missing their impact in the statewide races.
A lot of what is covered by local newspapers right now in media in general is often driven by the agendas that are being discussed at the State House and by the administration. So in recent years, we've seen more pushes towards social justice. We're seeing lots of discussion about climate change. We're seeing renewed discussion about Act 250 and sprawl and whether or not working landscape is really affordable for Vermont. And even housing crisis and other poverty issues, including the opioid epidemic. So there are a lot of issues that are dominating the papers and news coverage or news cycles that some folks would argue are democratic issues, and that the Vermont media tends to lean to the left because they are covering those issues kind of ad nauseum. But those are the issues that the people in power are talking about. And there's a distinction there because it's not that the news media is necessarily one way or another. It's that those are the issues that are being discussed.
Right. And if you go back over the years, you'll find that Bernie Sanders has been talking about those issues statewide and feeling like they were not discussed in the Vermont media.
Right.
And I think that this sort of goes back to what you were talking about when you mentioned my commentary in your paper yesterday, that Vermont is now the most democratic state in the nation. There are actual ratings to determine that, and Vermont is the most democratic state of the nation. It edges out Massachusetts, Maryland, and Hawaii, and California. And so because of that, you're seeing a lot of the debate focusing on these issues that are more of a progressive agenda. You might not see these issues covered the same way if you were in Texas, mm-hmm. but we're in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Are there particular issues that have come up in the debates and during this campaign that have surprised you?
None that come to mind.
Right.
I think we've seen a lot of focus on progressive issues, and we've seen a lot of agreement among the Democratic candidates. The ones that probably are been surprising is there's a undercurrent of discussion going on about law enforcement issues, especially in Tinton County in that state's attorney's race, and we're seeing a little bit of that in the U.S. House race on the Democratic side as well.
Yeah, that just emerged in the last few days. So, well, I want to take this moment to thank you for coming here today,
Steve.
Chris.
It's a pleasure.
Yeah,
thank you for inviting me.
Talk politics and. I'm sure the listeners will agree that it's been an enlightening conversation. Well, that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Dana McGivern. Feel free to suggest guests or topics for the show by emailing vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com, where you can also subscribe to the podcast. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Steve Pappas, sitting in for Rick Sangheri, who should be back in the seat tomorrow morning. And I would remind you, do not forget to vote tomorrow.